Hello again. I've done a little bit of writing on policy and politics, mostly using the platform of my letter to investors, which I write quarterly. And when I started reading Charles Krauthammer, I felt a little bit like I felt when I was a teenager interested in rock piano, and I started listening to Jerry Lee Lewis, and I felt I had two choices: sell the piano or just sit back and enjoy it and listen to the artistry and really enjoy somebody who had mastered something. Charles Krauthammer is a remarkable man. Leave aside all the awards, which I'll return to in a moment. Forget the hundreds of trenchant articles. Pay no heed to the enduring phrases coined. Forget even the remarkable way he overcame a devastating accident. How many of us can say that we have reached the pinnacle of success in not one but two difficult, demanding careers? Charles began his career as a medical doctor with a specialty in psychiatrics, expertise that continues to serve him well in his second career as an analyst of the Beltway Circus. He became the chief resident at one of the nation's best hospitals. He co-discovered a disease and authored scientific papers that continue to be cited to this day. Then, more than 30 years ago, he quit to try his hand at something else. Unfortunately, that something else was to work in the Carter administration and write speeches for Walter Mondale. I never said he was perfect. Nobody's perfect. But Charles learned from this, one of his few mistakes. The defenders of freedom and muscular foreign policy, who had, like Charles himself, coalesced around his hero, Scoop Jackson, were finding their ideas more welcome on the other side of the aisle. A crucible experience for Charles was a blistering attack he wrote in 1981 on the nuclear freeze movement. Many old friends were outraged, and some of them still are. Marty Peretz told Charles at the time that no article had ever prompted more canceled New Republic subscriptions. Too bad more weren't canceled, but all no doubt from people who most needed to hear what Charles had to say, but who were least equipped to accept or understand it. In any event, Charles emerged from the ordeal with many new friends, and he had found his voice. Charles has spent the last 30 years telling the truth without compromise. Never one to succumb to groupthink or partisan hackery, Charles's writing is infused with an intellectual seriousness and moral clarity that represents conservatism at its wisest. The complete lack of cant, the piercing insights, the economy of words. Charles is a man who doesn't get caught up in trendy fads or shallow enthusiasms. Often witty and sometimes withering, he's always free of rancor and bitterness. Today, he's a weekly columnist for the Washington Post, where his column is syndicated in more than 200 papers. He's a contributing editor to the New Republic and the Weekly Standard, a regular panelist on Fox's Evening News, the program's Special Report, and a weekly panelist on PBS's Inside Washington. Along the way, Charles has picked up many awards, including the Pulitzer Prize for Distinguished Commentary and the National Magazine Award for Essays, the Irving Kristol Award from the American Enterprise Institute, and the Bradley Prize. More than honors, as impressive as they are, what has always struck me about Charles's writing is the range of his interests, from national security and foreign policy to bioethics, from judicial philosophy to energy to healthcare, from politics to movies to deeply moving tributes to those whom he has known and loved. Few important topics fall outside his areas of interest and knowledge. Charles also has a gift of crystallizing a moment in history, of explaining what is unfolding and why it matters. His essays, from The Reagan Doctrine in the 1980s to The Unipolar Moment in the 1990s to Democratic Realism in this decade, have shaped about how we think about the world in which we live. In the introduction of his book of essays from the 1980s, Cutting Edges, Charles quotes the English playwright Tom Stoppard, who who talks about trying to, quote, nudge the world a little, close quote. That is his goal as well, Krauthammer wrote, to nudge the world a little. Well, Charles Krauthammer has nudged the world more than a little. He's in fact nudged it quite a lot. And the world and all of us are better because of it. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to introduce you, Charles Krauthammer.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for that kind introduction. Since you brought up Mondale, I'm often asked, how do you go from Walter Mondale to Fox News? The answer is simple. I was young once. I have some breaking news. I was asked by the board of directors of the Manhattan Institute to announce that the 2016 Riston Lecture, don't get ahead of me now, has been awarded to the city of Chicago. What sealed the deal, I'm told, was that President Obama's personal appeal was persuasive. Michelle's outfit was outstanding and sleeveless. And Oprah made them cry. However, the clincher was Rahm Emanuel. His presentation, I'm told in confidence, was the most persuasive since the 1996 Riston Award was awarded to Brooklyn after a particularly persuasive presentation by John Gotti. I knew you'd like it, Robbie. I could go on, and I'd like to. These are easy. You can try these at home tonight. But I do have a lecture prepared. The topic of the lecture is American Decline, and the title is Decline is a Choice. The weather vanes of conventional wisdom have kicked off another round of angst about American in decline. New theories, old slogans, imperial overstretch, the Asian awakening, the post-American world, inexorable forces beyond our control bringing the inevitable humbling of the world hegemon. On the other side of this debate are a few, notably Joe Joffe in a recent essay in Foreign Affairs, who resist the current fashion and insist that America remains the indispensable power. They point out that these declinist predictions are cyclical, that the rise of China and perhaps India are the current version of the Japanese panic of the late 1980s or of the earlier pessimism captured best by Jean-François Ravel's How Democracies Perish. The anti-decliners point out, for example, that the fear of China is overblown, is based on implausible assumptions of indefinite, uninterrupted growth, ignores accumulating externalities like pollution, which can be ignored when the growth starts from a very low baseline, but ends up making the growth increasingly, chokingly difficult, and overlooks the unavoidable consequences of the one-child policy, which guarantees that China will get old before it gets rich. Just as the rise of China is a straight-line projection of current economic trends, American decline is a straight-line projection of the fearful, pessimistic mood of a country war-weary and in the grip of a severe recession. Among these cross currents, my thesis tonight is simple. The question of whether America is in decline cannot be answered yes or no. There is no yes or no. both answers are wrong, because the assumption that somehow there exists some predetermined, inevitable trajectory, the result of uncontrollable external forces, is wrong. Nothing is inevitable. Nothing is written. Decline is not a condition. Decline is a choice. America is in the position today, 20 years after the beginning of the unipolar era, that it came to dominate with the fall of the Soviet Union, of deciding whether to abdicate or retain its dominance. Decline or continued ascendancy is in our hands. Not that decline or even rise is always a choice. Britain's decline after the Second World War was foretold, and indeed was, as was that of Europe, as the dominant global force in the world. The civilizational suicide that was the Second World War, and the consequent physical and psychological exhaustion, made continued European dominance impossible. The corollary of unchosen European collapse was unchosen American ascendancy. We, whom Lincoln once called God's almost chosen people, did not save Europe twice in order to emerge from the ashes as the world co-hegemon. We went in to defend ourselves and save civilization. Our dominance after the Second World War was not sought, nor was the even more remarkable dominance after the Soviet collapse. We are the rarest of geopolitical phenomena, the accidental hegemon, and given our isolationism and lack of instinctive imperial ambition, the reluctant hegemon. And now, after a near decade of strenuous post-9/11 exertion, more reluctant than ever. Which leads to my second proposition. Facing the choice of whether to maintain our dominance or to gradually, deliberately, willingly, indeed relievedly give it up, we are headed currently on a course towards the latter. The current liberal ascendancy in the United States, controlling the executive and the Congress, dominating the media and elite culture, has set us on a course for decline. And this is true for both foreign and domestic policy. Indeed, they work synergistically to ensure that outcome. The current foreign policy of the United States is an exercise in contraction. It begins with the demolition of the moral foundation of American dominance. In Strasbourg, the president was asked about American exceptionalism. His answer, quote, "I believe in American exceptionalism, just as I suspect that the Brits believe in British exceptionalism and the Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism." Interesting response, because if everyone is exceptional, no one is. Indeed, as he made his Hajj from Strasbourg to Prague to Ankara to Istanbul to Cairo and finally to the UN General Assembly, Obama drew a picture of America quite exceptional, exceptional in moral culpability and heavy-handedness, exceptional in guilt and its treatment of other nations and peoples. With varying degrees of directness or obliqueness, Obama indicted America for arrogance, for dismissiveness and derisiveness towards Europe, for maltreatment of natives, for torture, Hiroshima, Guantanamo, unilateralism, and for insufficient respect for the Muslim world. Quite an indictment, the fundamental consequence of which is to effectively undermine any moral claim America might have to world leadership, as well as to undermine the moral confidence that any nation needs to have in order to justify to itself and to others its position of leadership. Having forfeited the mandate of heaven, if it ever had it, A newly humbled America now seeks a more modest place among the nations and not above them. But that leads to a question. How does this new world govern itself? How is the international system to function? Henry Kissinger once noted, 20 years ago at a Heritage Foundation lecture, I took notes, that the only way to achieve peace is through hegemony or balance of power. Well, hegemony is apparently out. As Obama said in his General Assembly address, quote, no one nation can or should try to dominate another. The can of that declaration is priceless. And if hegemony is out, so is balance of power. Quote, no balance of power among nations will hold. The president then denounced the idea of elevating any group of nations above others, which takes care, I suppose, of the Security Council, the G20, and the Western Alliance. And just to make the point unmistakable, he denounced, quote, alignments of nations rooted in the cleavages of a long-gone Cold War as, quote, making no sense in an interconnected world. Well, what does that say about NATO, of our alliance with Japan or South Korea, or even of the European Union? Surely this is nonsense. But it is not harmless nonsense. It's nonsense with a point. It reflects a fundamental view that the only legitimate authority in the international system is that which emanates from the, quote, community of nations as a whole, which means, I suppose, acting through its most universal organs, such as, again, I suppose, the UN and its agencies, which is why when Obama boasted of his achievements over the last 9 months, he listed among his restorative and re-legitimizing initiatives the paying of UN dues, the engagement in a series of useless international negotiations on even more useless international conventions, and the joining of UN bodies such as, I kid you not, the UN Human Rights Council. To be sure, the idea of the international community acting through the UN, a fiction and a farce respectively, as enforcers of norms and maintainers of stability is absurd. So absurd, I suspect, that it's really just a metaphorical image for a world run by a kind of multipolar arrangement, not of nation states, but of groups of states acting through multilateral bodies, whether institutional, such as the IAEA, or ad hoc, like the P5+1 negotiations with Iran. But whatever bizarre form of multilateral or universal structures are envisioned for keeping world order, certainly hegemony, and certainly American hegemony, is to be retired. The renunciation of primacy is not entirely new. Liberal internationalism, as practiced in the 1990s, the beginning of the unipolar era, by the center-left Clinton administration, was somewhat ambivalent about American hegemony, although it did allow America to be characterized as the indispensable nation, to use the phrase of Madeleine Albright. This Clintonian center-left liberal internationalism did not sought to restrain American power by tying Gulliver down with a myriad of constraining treaties and agreements and conventions. That conscious constraining of American power within international bureaucratic and normative structures was rooted in the notion that the power corrupts and that external restraints would curb arrogance and overreaching and break a willful America to the role of good international citizen. But the liberal internationalism of today is different. It is not center-left, it's left-liberal. And the new left-liberal internationalism goes far beyond its early Clintonian incarnation in its distrust of and distaste for American dominance. For what might be called the new liberalism, the renunciation of power is rooted not in the fear that we are essentially a good nation, but subject to the corruptions of power, the old center-left view, but rooted in the idea that America is so intrinsically flawed, so inherently and congenitally sinful, that it cannot be trusted with and does not merit the possession of overarching world power. For the new liberalism, it's not just that power corrupts. It's that America itself is corrupt in the sense of being deeply flawed and with the history to prove it. An imperfect union, theme of Obama's famous Philadelphia race speech, has been carried to and amplified in every major foreign policy address he has delivered, particularly the ones he delivered on foreign soil, not surprisingly, since there it garners greater applause. But because we remain so imperfect a nation, we are in no position to dictate our professed values to others around the world. Thus, demonstrators are shot in the streets of Tehran, seeking nothing but freedom. But our president holds his tongue because, as he said openly, of our own alleged sins towards Iran, presumably Eisenhower's involvement in a coup more than 50 years ago. Our shortcomings are so grave, and our offenses, domestic and international, so serious that we really do not have the moral authority, the moral ground on which to justify hegemony. These tenets of the new liberalism are not just theory. They have strategic consequences. If we have been illegitimately playing the role of world hegemon, as we have, then for us to regain a legitimate place in the international system, we must regain our moral authority. And recovering moral space means renouncing ill-gotten or ill-conceived strategic space. Operationally, this shows itself in various kinds of strategic retreat, most particularly in reversing policies stained by even the hint of American unilateralism or exceptionalism. Thus, for example, there is no more global war on terror. It's not just that the term has been abolished or that the Secretary of Homeland Security refers to terrorism now as, quote, man-caused disasters, believe it or not. It is that the very idea that our nation and civilization are engaged in global mortal combat with jihadism has been retired as well. The operational consequences of that new view are already manifest. In our reversion to pre-9/11 normalcy, or the pretense of pre-9/11 normalcy, anti-terrorism has gone back from war fighting to law enforcement. Hence, for example, high-level Al-Qaeda prisoners will no longer be interrogated by the CIA, but by the FBI, just as our response to the pre-9/11 attack on the coal, an act of war, was to send FBI agents into Yemen. The other operational consequences of this voluntary contraction are already evident. First, unilateral abrogation of our missile defense arrangements with Poland and the Czech Republic, that retreat being felt through all of Eastern Europe to Georgia and Ukraine as a signal of American concession of strategic space to Russia in its own sphere of influence. Second, serious contemplation of retreat in Afghanistan. Only 2 months ago, it was a war of necessity, with possibly catastrophic consequences for Pakistan. Three, in Iraq, a determination to end the war according to existing timetables with almost no interest in garnering the fruits of a very costly and bloody success, namely using our strategic framework agreement to turn the new Iraq into a partner, an anchor for U.S. influence in this critical region of the world. It's a prize. We can debate whether it was worth the cost. But Iraq is a prize of great strategic significance that the administration seems to have no intention of exploiting in its determination to execute a full and final exit. Fourth, as noted earlier with Iran, because of our alleged sinful history, we stand silent as democratic demonstrators are beaten in the streets. And fifth, this even extends to Honduras, where again, because of our supposed sinful past, we back a Chavista Caudillo removed from power by the legitimate organs of the state for grave constitutional offenses. The new liberalism will protest that despite its rhetoric, it's not engaging in moral reparations, but seeking only real strategic advantage for the United States on the assumption that the reason we have received little cooperation from, say, the Russians or Iranians or North Koreans or even our European allies on our various urgent agendas is because of American arrogance and unilateralism and dismissiveness in previous years. And therefore, if we constrict and rebrand and diminish ourselves deliberately, try to make ourselves equal partners with otherwise obviously unequal powers abroad, we will gain the moral high ground and rally the world to our causes. Well, that being a strategic argument, the hypothesis is testable. Let's tally up the empirical evidence of what 9 months of self-abasement has brought. With all the bowing and scraping and apologizing and renouncing, we couldn't even sway the Olympic Committee. You can see a theme developing here. The Olympic Committee, an audience perfectly conducive, one would have imagined, to such demonstrations of American self-deprecation, consisting, as that the committee does, of pedigreed global Eurotrash for whom denigration of America is a welcome sign of sophistication. Don't worry, that won't appear in the printed text. But I couldn't resist here tonight. Unilateral American concessions and offers of unconditional engagement certainly have moved neither Iran nor Russia nor North Korea to accommodate us. Nor have the Arab states or even the powerless Palestinian Authority even made a gesture of accommodation in response to heavy and gratuitous American pressure on Israel. Nor have even our European allies responded. They have ended up essentially nothing in response to our pleas for more assistance in Afghanistan. This deliberate choice of strategic retreat to engender goodwill has demonstrably produced no strategic gains. But that will not deter the new liberalism, because its ultimate purpose of its foreign policy is to make America less hegemonic, less arrogant, less dominant. In a word, it is designed to produce American decline, to make America essentially one nation among many. And for that purpose, the domestic policies of the new liberalism are perfectly complementary. Domestic policy, of course, is not designed to curb our power abroad, but what it lacks in intent, it makes up in effect. Decline will be an unintended but very powerful side effect of the new liberalism ambition of moving America away from its traditional dynamic individualism to the more equitable but static model of European social democracy. Now, this is not the place to debate the intrinsic merits of the social democratic versus the more Anglo-Saxon model of capitalism. There is much to be said for the decency and the relative equity of social democracy, but it comes at a cost: diminished social mobility, higher unemployment, less innovation, less dynamism and creative destruction, less overall economic growth. This affects the ability to project power. Growth provides the sinews of dominance, the ability to maintain a large military establishment capable of projecting power to all corners of the earth. The Europeans, rich and developed, have almost no such capacity. They made the choice long ago to devote their resources to a vast welfare state. Their expenditures on defense are minimal, as is reflected in their consequent military capacities. They rely on the U.S. Navy for open seas and on the U.S. Air Force for airlift. It's the Marines who go ashore, the American Marines who go ashore, not just in battle, but for such global social services as tsunami relief. The U.S. can do this, and no one else can, because we spend infinitely more on defense, more than the next nine countries combined. Those are the conditions today, but they are not static or permanent. They require a constant renewal. The express agenda of the new liberalism is a vast expansion of the social safety net, massive intervention and expenditures in energy, healthcare, and education that will necessarily, as in Europe, take away from defense spending. This shift in resources is not hypothetical. It is already happening. At a time when hundreds of billions of dollars are being lavished in stimulus and other expenditures on an endless array of domestic projects, the defense budget is practically frozen. Almost every other department of government is expanding. The Defense Department is singled out for making, quote, hard choices, for looking everywhere for cuts, for abandoning advanced weapon systems, for having to choose between readiness and research, between today's urgencies and tomorrow's threats. Take, for example, missile defense, in which America has a great technological edge and which is perfectly designed to maintain American preeminence in a century that will be dominated by the ballistic missile. Missile defense is actually being cut. The number of interceptors in Alaska to defend against a North Korean attack is reduced at a time when, for example, the federal education budget is being increased by 100% in a single year. This preference for social goods over security needs is not just evident in budgetary allocations and priorities. It is seen, for example, in the liberal preference for environmental goods. By prohibiting drilling offshore and Arctic deposits, the United States is voluntarily and deliberately denying itself access to vast amounts of oil that will relieve dependency on and help to curb the wealth and power of the various petrodollar challengers from Iran to Venezuela to Russia. Again, we can argue over whether the environment versus security trade-off is warranted, but there is no denying that there is a trade-off, and nor are these the only trade-offs. Primacy in space, such a galvanizing symbol of American greatness so well understood and championed by John Kennedy, is gradually being relinquished. In the current reconsiderations of all things Bush, the idea of returning to the moon in the next decade is being jettisoned. After next September, the shuttle will never fly again. It will be retired, and we will be entirely incapable of returning even to near-Earth orbit, let alone to the moon. Instead, we will be completely dependent on the Russians and the Chinese. Our symbolic, of a symbolic but more concrete importance, is the status of the dollar. The social democratic vision necessarily involves huge increases in social expenditures, most immediately for expanded health care. Current estimate from the Congressional Budget Office placed that cost alone at between $1 to $2 trillion. And remember, that is $1 to $2 trillion added to the monstrous deficits the CBO is projecting conservatively as $7 trillion over the next decade. The effect on the dollar is already being felt and could ultimately lead to a catastrophic collapse or to hyperinflation. Moreover, having control of the world's reserve currency is an irreplaceable national asset. Yet with every new and growing estimate of the explosion of national debt, there are more and more voices calling for replacement of the dollar as the world currency, not just from adversaries like Russia and China, Iran or Venezuela, as one would expect, but just last week from the head of the World Bank. There's no free lunch. Social democracy and its attendant goods are highly desirable, but they have a price that will be exacted on the dollar, on missile defense, on our primacy in space, on energy security, and on our military capacities and future power projection. But of course, if one's foreign policy is to reject the very notion of international primacy in the first place, a domestic agenda that takes away the resources to maintain primacy is perfectly complementary. Indeed, it is synergistic. Renunciation of primacy abroad provides, as in Europe, the added resources for more domestic social goods. To put it in the language of the 1990s, the expanded domestic agenda is fed by a peace dividend, except that in the absence of real peace, it is in reality a retreat dividend. And that's the rub. For the Europeans, there really is a peace dividend because we provide the peace. They can afford their social democracies without the capacity to defend themselves, because they can always depend on the United States. So why not us as well? Because what for Europe is decadence, decline in comfort and relative safety, for us is mere denial. Europe can eat, drink, and be merry, for America protects her. But for America, it's different. If we choose the life of ease, who stands a guard for us or for all of us? The temptation to advocate has always, to abdicate, has always been strong in America. Our interventionist tradition is recent. Our isolationist history goes far deeper. Nor is it restricted to the American left. Historically, of course, it was championed by the American right, until the Vandenberg conversion. But it remains a bipartisan instinct. When the era of maximum dominance began 20 years ago, when to general surprise, a unipolar world emerged rather than a multipolar coast world war world emerged, there was hesitation about accepting the mantle. And it wasn't only among liberals. In the fall of 1990, Jean Kirkpatrick, hero of the struggle to defeat the Soviet Union, argued that after a half century of exertion, fighting fascism, Nazism, and communists, quote, it's time to give up the dubious benefits of superpower status, time to give up the unusual burdens of the past and return to normal times. No more your balancing power in Europe or Asia. We should aspire instead, she wrote, to be, quote, a normal country in a normal time. Now, that call to retreat was rejected by most of American conservatism, as Pat Buchanan has amply demonstrated by his very marginality. But it did find some resonance in mainstream liberalism. At first, however, only some resonance. As I noted earlier, the liberal internationalism of the 90s, the center-left Clintonian version, was reluctant to fully embrace American hegemony and did try to rein it in by creating external constraints. Nonetheless, in practice, it did boldly intervene in the Balkan Wars without the sanction of the Security Council, incidentally, and openly accepted a kind of intermediate status as the indispensable nation. But not today. The ascendant new liberalism of today goes much further, actively seeking to subsume America within the international community and to enact a domestic social agenda to suit. So why not? Why not choose ease and bask in the adulation of the world as we serially renounce, withdraw, and concede? Because while globalization has produced in some the illusion that human nature has changed, it has not. The international arena remains a Hobbesian state of nature in which countries naturally strive for power. If we renounce much of ours, others will not follow suit. They will fill the vacuum. Inevitably, an inversion of power relations will occur. Do we really want to live under an unknown, untested, shifting multipolarity? Or even worse, under the gauzy internationalism of the new liberalism with its magically self-enforcing norms? This is sometimes passed off as realism. In fact, it's the worst of utopian fantasies, a fiction that can lead only to chaos. Indeed, in an age when the threshold on the threshold of hyperproliferation, it is a prescription for catastrophe. Heavy are the burdens of the hegemon, particularly after the blood and treasure expended in the post 9/11 wars. America is quite ready to ease its burden. Unfortunately, we must resist the temptation of abdication. Decline is a choice. We must resist the temptation. How? First, accept our role as hegemon and reject those who deny its essential benignity. There is a reason we are the only hegemon in modern history to have not immediately catalyzed the creation of a massive counter-hegemonic alliance, as occurred, for example, against Napoleonic France and Nazi Germany. There is a reason so many countries in the Pacific Rim and the Middle East and Latin America and Eastern Europe welcome America, welcome its presence as a balancer of power and guarantor of their freedom. And the reason is simple. We are as benign a hegemon as the world has ever seen. So resistance to decline begins with the moral self-confidence and will. But maintaining dominance is a matter not just of will, but of wallet. We are not inherently in economic decline. We have the most dynamic, innovative, technologically advanced economy in the world. We enjoy the highest productivity. It is true that in the natural and often painful global division of labor wrought by globalization, less skilled endeavors like factory work migrate overseas. But America more than compensates by pioneering newer technologies and industries of the information age. There are, of course, major threats to the American economy, but there is nothing inevitable or inexorable about them. Take, for example, the threat to the dollar as the world's reserve currency that comes from our massive trade deficits. Here again, the China threat is vastly exaggerated. In fact, fully two-thirds of our trade imbalance comes from imported oil. And this is not a fixed fact of life. Here again, we have a choice. The problem is soluble. For example, we have it in our power to reverse the absurd de facto 30-year ban on new nuclear power plants. We have it in our power to release huge amounts of petroleum reserves by dropping the ban on offshore and Arctic drilling. And we have it in our power to institute a serious gasoline tax, refunded through a payroll tax, to curb our consumption. Nothing is written. Nothing is predetermined. We can reverse the slide. We can undo our dependence if we have the will. The other looming threat to our economy and to the dollar comes from our fiscal deficits. They are not out of our control. There is no reason we should be structurally perpetuating the massive deficits incurred as temporary crisis measures during the financial panic of 2008. A crisis is a terrible thing to exploit when it is taken by the new liberalism as a mandate for massive expansion of the state and of national debt, threatening the dollar, our entire economy, and as a consequence, our superpower status abroad. There are things to be done. Resist retreat as a matter of strategy and principle, and provide the means to continue our dominant role in the world by keeping our economic house in order. And finally, we can heed the advice of Demosthenes when he was asked what was to be done about the decline of Athens. His reply, "I will give what I believe is the fairest and truest answer. Don't do what you are doing now." Thank you very much.
Charles has agreed to answer a few questions. Since the evening is running on, there's several microphones out there. I just ask you to raise your hand. I'll acknowledge you and wait for the microphone to get to you, and you can ask Charles your question. So if you have any questions, please raise your hand. Any questions? I can't. Over there. All right, go ahead.
Mr. Krauthammer, thank you very much for that compelling lecture, and one of full of thought and intellect. In the end, we're confronted with the fact that America is this great experiment, this audacious claim that a free people can rule themselves. An extraordinary discontinuity in the history of the world. And I'm curious as to your own assessment about this great experiment, given the challenges that you so artfully laid out for us tonight.
Well, the euphoria of the 80s and the 90s are gone. And there really is a question of whether the pessimism is warranted. Again, my thesis is that this is not a fixed condition and there are no written laws and rules, but it is a matter of will. Revel's book, which came out in 1984, I believe, basically concluded that democracy was an accident of history. Remember, that was only 5 years before the fall of the Berlin Wall. So we had a radical reversal of what appeared to be our fortunes. And I thought that was a matter of will. Reaganism was a matter of American will. It was not inevitable. It was not foretold. He was elected, he acted, he had support, America was with him, and he did what in many ways was thought to be impossible. Remember when he came into office, it was assumed there was another meme and theme among the chattering classes was that America had become ungovernable, too difficult. It couldn't be done. It was not ungovernable. It had been badly governed. And that, I think, is exactly where we are today. We really are at a cusp. When I wrote the unipolar moment in 1990, I speculated that we would be the dominant global power unchallenged for perhaps 30 to 40 years. And if so, we're right now at the midpoint. We're really at a cusp. And there is this sense of pessimism that somehow things are out of our control. And I think that really is a result of the projection of the malaise that comes from war weariness and from this recession. But recessions come and recessions go, and wars ultimately end. So I think there is a misreading of the American mood. The problem is that we have elected an unknown man with an unknown agenda who sort of unmasked himself openly right after his election and announced himself as a man of the left. He's not a communist or a socialist, he's a social democrat, which is respectable, but for America, rather unusual. The politics in America occurs between the 40-yard lines. In Europe, it's goal line to goal line. Obama is trying to push America to the 30-yard line. He's not a radical by European standards, but he is a radical by American standards. And the question is whether America will follow. In the end, I think I am rather optimistic because I think America will say no.
Is there another question over here? Claudia Rosette.
Thank you for that magnificent lecture.
Thank you.
I get the despairing sense looking at the institutions that make this country run, academics, politics, the media, that the new liberalism you described has infested all these things. Where does one begin to reverse this? I mean, my neighbor down the street understands what you have said, but he feels helpless to do anything.
Well, it's a good question, but in fact, your neighbor is the saving grace and the reason why in the end America will say no. It is remarkable that given the fact that liberals have taken over the last 30 years, the commanding heights of the culture, the universities, the foundations, Hollywood, the museums, everything, America remains center-right. In the latest polls, if you ask people ideology, not party, which is sort of a fickle response to events, scandals, whatever, but you ask them about ideology, the number of the people who identify themselves as conservative remains twice the number of those who do liberal. It's about 22% liberal, about 45% conservative. High 30s are moderates. That remains unchanged. It's like water on a rock. It's a miracle of sorts. It has to do with the basic, not just decency, but intelligence of the American people, that they have resisted unrelenting propaganda from all sides, the media, education, pedagogy, and wherever. It's interesting to note that if you go to any Ivy League school, the students are more conservative than the professors, which means that the professoriate has failed. And it does repeatedly. I can't quite understand why, because it doesn't happen in other countries, but it happens in ours. And I think there is something alien about the new liberalism, something so sort of European, social democratic, outside of the mainstream. Americans see themselves as individualistic, dynamic, different, and they do not want to be ruled by the state. that remains fundamental to their understanding of themselves, and it transcends recession. The mistake of this administration is that it really thought that with America in a panic as a result of what happened last year, it was something like the panic in the early 30s, and they could exploit the crisis to pass a huge social agenda unrelated to the causes of the crisis. But America didn't buy it. When Obama said in his first address to Congress in early February that in order not to repeat this mess, we're going to have to reform healthcare, education, and energy, it was a non sequitur that everybody understood, including your neighbor. One had nothing at all to do with the other. Whatever the causes of the financial meltdown, it was not the absence of universal health insurance. And in the end, when you try to sell a $1 trillion expenditure on a non sequitur, you fail.
We have Ken Bielkin.
I hope you fail.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your usual brilliance. I couldn't bring anything more to it than to say we got what we expected, and we expected the best. In your survey, one place you did not touch, somewhat relievedly, that is, I think it's nice that you could utter a long speech of such erudition and not touch the subject of the Middle East. And that's refreshing. But I'd like to put one question to you, because so many of us think that the present occupant of the White House is revising American leadership in a way in which America, as Israel's strongest ally, friend, guide, and protector, might be weakened. And if that should happen, if it goes so far before the forces of right, as you say, so to speak, rescue the world, if in fact Israel begins to lose the kind of support that's being signaled now, whither Israel, the Israelis think their main ally and friend, is the United States. And if that should weaken, and if Israel begins to have its confidence shaken in the hegemony and reliability of Israel, will it turn elsewhere? After all, Russia or Soviet Union was the second country to recognize Israel's existence in 1948. And I wonder whether the Israelis may or ought to may be looking for help in other precincts.
I would agree that you're on with your acute observation that in a room with so many Jews, the word Israel only came up once in 2 hours. Yeah. That's called a delayed charge. Did you really say that? We are off the record, aren't we? No, I think it's a good point. I don't think Israel has any alternatives. This is not 48. And Stalin and the Czech arms deal and all that was a way for the Soviets to get the British out of Palestine and Middle East. So it was a two-cushion shot, and there's only one cushion left. The British are gone, and the Israelis are there. And there's no way in which Israel has any alternative. But again, here I'm not that pessimistic. I think in the short run, yes, and the short run, of course, is what we live in, and the short run is going to be extremely dangerous, meaning the short run of Iran coming to the point of acquiring a nuclear weapon. And that's going to be extremely problematic, and having Obama in office is going to make things very difficult, and I think in the end will force Israel's hand to attack. With or without a yellow light, it's not going to get a green light. It's not going to get a yellow light, I think. If it gets a blinking red light, it will go. And I think it'll go even if it has a full stop, a signal from the United States. It will risk a rupture with America. But again, in the end, America is not a country that would abandon Israel. Obama is an outlier in that sense. And the coterie of people around him are outliers. It's again amazing, with all the propaganda against the United States, you watch CNN, you think, I mean, against Israel, you watch CNN, CNN International, the BBC, or read even the major papers, and you get an idea of Israel as a war criminal in the Gaza engagement. In the face of all that, the support for Israel is almost unchanged in the last 30 years. Again, a bedrock sense of decency and native intelligence. And I think in America, you can only stray so far outside the national consensus. You can do it temporarily. You can do it for a year or two. You can do it in a policy or two. But in the end, that support remains. Remember, America has the largest sort of non-Jewish basis of support population that strongly, intrinsically supports Israel of any place in the world, with almost 50 million evangelicals, far outnumbering Jews. So it's not really a Jewish lobby. It's an Israel lobby, which is overwhelmingly Christian. So even as the numbers of Jews declines and their influence declines over time, I think that the bedrock support remains. But I am concerned about the next year or two. I think Obama is wasting a lot of time. I don't know if it's deliberate or not. I tend to think it's naivete and not deliberate. My rule in Washington is whenever you're faced with a puzzling phenomenon and your choices are incompetence or conspiracy, always assume incompetence. Because conspiracy gives them much too much credit. So I think he really believes that his powers of persuasion will work on the Iranians, and he'll be disabused. So I am concerned about the short run, but in the end, I think the Israeli-American alliance will remain strong. And the Israelis understand that. And that's why, even though you've had a gesture or two towards the Russians, I think those are extremely narrow in their agendas. I think the visit that Bibi took to Moscow was exclusively to try to get a delay in the delivery or a cancellation of the delivery of the anti-missile missiles, the anti-aircraft missiles, which would, I think he told the Russians, would precipitate an immediate Israeli attack.
Well, I think we could go on, but I think it's best we adjourn. Charles, if ideas can move the world, I think you've nudged us a little bit tonight, and I want to thank you, and I want to thank all of you for coming. I think it is clear how fortunate we are to believe in the power of ideas.
Supply the common sense and the fresh thinking of the Manhattan.